ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning, Houston. We are 202,306 nautical miles away. Earth is pulling us back, and we are happy about that. We're ready for morning DPC.
After the huge high of the lunar flyby, the Artemis astronauts are heading back to Earth.
And scientists on the ground are hard at work unpacking their observations.
Integrity, science, I have to start with a giant wow.
I'm ABC science reporter Jacinta Bowler.
And I'm Belinda Smith. This is Artemis Explained, a daily podcast following the Artemis 2 mission to and from the moon.
For science fiction on ABC Radio National.
All right, day 7 of the mission, Jacinta. Give it to me, mission in under a minute. Go.
Okay. They left the lunar sphere of influence at about 3 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard this morning. Some photos have arrived back on Earth and they are beautiful. The astronauts had a call with the ISS and President Trump. And our favourite, Dr. Kelsey Young, had a very exciting lunar science debrief. And the astronauts are packing up the cabin for landing.
So with the photos that we've received, we haven't got all the data from the observations yet, but we have some. How much do we have?
Quite a bit, but definitely not all of it. So we know that through the optical comms, they've managed to get 20 gigabytes down in 45 minutes. So
Whoa.
That is many, 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 many cool photos.
So literally thousands and thousands of photos have made their way from Integrity to Earth.
They've
already
made it back. They're just a couple of days ahead of the astronauts. There's some silly ones as well. They're not all stunning. There was one of them wearing their cardboard eclipse glasses in a selfie.
Cardboard?
Yeah.
They can take up a jar of Nutella, but they can't give them decent eclipse glasses.
I mean, I kind of understand it. They pack away real small.
I suppose so. Okay. So tell me about these pickies.
So I wanted to firstly note that these photos really do look like a human has like framed them up and gotten the best shot. It's kind of amazing. Like they don't look like the photos that we see from, you know, moon's orbital satellites, like the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, for instance. And so I thought it could be fun if we described our favourites.
Sure.
I'll start. So NASA has named this particular photo the Setting Earth. It might be a little basic to be the fave because it's kind of been everywhere, but I love it. So in the photo, the moon, the grey cratered surface takes up the vast majority of the frame. And then peeking behind it, there's this Earth, only half of it's lit up and half of it's in shadow. It's gorgeous.
Like a crescent Earth in the distance.
What about you, Belle?
So nice. Well, my favourite is probably one of the eclipse photos. So there are a few photos snapped, not from within the capsule, but from a camera hanging off the side of it. And this one shows a little bit of the capsule, but it's the moon covering the sun. So what you have is this beautiful dark orb, and that's the moon. And it looks almost like, you know, when astronomy papers come out and they have artists' impressions, It kind of looks a bit like that. It looks really otherworldly. Doesn't look real, but it is real because it's being backlit by the sun. You can sort of see a little bit of one edge is lit up slightly. So it's a cratered surface, so it is recognisably the moon. But what you can also see is the coronal outline of the sun itself. And so you can sort of see the light and shade around the sun, which is being highlighted by the fact that the moon's sitting right in front of it.
We're nerding out in here. How good.
And then also, there's Saturn in the photo and Mars. It's just a reminder that the solar system is just an amazing place, isn't it?
It is. It really is.
And actually, something else that came out overnight was a little bit more information about the micrometeorites that I mentioned yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
So the astronauts, during their lunar flyby, in the space of about half an hour, picked up 4 to 6 what they call impact flashes. So these are the split-second flashes of light that are caused when something really small, like a meteorite, hits the surface of the moon. Now, these flashes of light aren't like the flash of a camera. They're quite dim, so you need a very dark moon to see them. So when it's in full solar eclipse and the sun is not shining on the side that they're looking at, that's when you see these micrometeorite impact flashes. And the reason that this is interesting is because this kind of information is useful for future missions. And if you're building a moon base, you want to know what might hit it and how often and where it's coming from, that kind of thing. And actually seeing those micrometeorites was a very pleasant surprise for the NASA scientists. This is what moon scientist Dr. Kelsey Young had to say.
I don't know if I expected to have the crew see any on this mission, so you probably saw the surprise and shock on my face. And though I was not in the science evaluation room, I heard that there were audible screams of delight. So very excited science community.
So after the astronauts had a little sleep, I don't know how well they slept, probably fairly fitfully, they had a debrief with the NASA scientists here on Earth about what they saw and about the lunar science. And something that came up was Ohm crater. Now, we've talked a little bit about the importance of describing colour on the moon, which to my eyes looks very grey. What did they have to say about Ohm crater?
Ohm crater is one of the craters on the far side of the moon. It's about 64 kilometres across. Dr. Young said that the colour of the Ohm crater and what surrounds it might actually tell us a bit about the chemistry of the moon below its surface.
Impact events are really compelling for a lot of reasons. Obviously, I'm quite biased, having written my PhD on them. But they can excavate material from great depths below the surface, which means they're kind of like a geologist cheat code, right? Where it's you can't get all the way down there by yourself, but when an impact has brought up that material for you, it can actually perform that excavation, and we just need to send the crew to the right spots on the surface, and they can actually look at depths far below the surface.
And there was some chat about the Terminator on the moon. I'm assuming this is not some kind of robot hell-bent on killing people from the past. What's the Terminator on the moon?
No, so it's also known as the Twilight Zone. So it's the point where you are coming from day to night on a planetary body. So as they're moving around, you know, you can see that there's a light side and a dark side. That little bit in the middle, that there is the Terminator Zone.
The lighting conditions along the Terminator that the crew experienced yesterday do mimic, in many ways, the lighting conditions of the South Polar region. The low sun angles, the dramatic lighting causing the extreme shadowing, and illumination also accentuating topography. This is really important for our agency's future moon base plans and understanding how crew member observations can contribute to future mission planning.
Now, as important as the moon science updates, we also got a toilet update. And we found out a little bit more about that toilet no-go call we mentioned yesterday. What do we know about it now?
Are we too obsessed with the toilet?
I don't think so. I think this is good stuff.
This is the right amount of toilet content.
I think so.
Okay, well, you'll all be very happy to know that they figured out it is not the vent out to space that's icing over. So we were worried that it was getting icy and so they couldn't actually release their pee out into space, which is what they were trying to do with this.
Yeah, the icing is a big issue, isn't it? Because I also saw that there's a hose from the toilet to the vent and they were worried that maybe that was icing over as well. But they've got little heaters around that tube. Heaters are on. It's not icing over. So something else is afoot.
Yeah. We had some updates today. The team suspect that it might be some kind of chemical reaction happening inside the toilet. There is stuff in the toilet to be able to try and limit biofilms. And so there is chemicals in there, and that's what they're using.
What's a biofilm?
A biofilm, it's bacteria that forms into like a slimy mess. So if you've got, for example, if you have a toothbrush holder at the bottom of that, the like gunk that builds up, that's a biofilm.
Okay, nice.
Yeah. They think that maybe there's something going on as a chemical reaction that may be causing the blockage, but they probably can't work it out until they get it back to Earth, pull it apart and see what's going wrong.
And so what do the astronauts do in the meantime? They've still got 3 days to go.
Yeah, so the toilet itself works. It's just that they can't keep peeing in there or it will overflow. So instead of that, they are back to bags unless they can somehow fix the issue in the next 2 days.
Last item for the toilet, no Oxone R&R for today's toilet maintenance. Over.
Okay, I do love the smell of Oxone in the morning, but it sounds good. No R&R today.
Roger that.
Another unscheduled toilet issue, but something that was scheduled for their trip back was a bit of a chat with the International Space Station. How did that go?
I love this. I mean, so we have been spending a lot of time talking about the Artemis mission, but there are still other astronauts in space.
Won't someone think of the space station, really, in all this?
They're still having a good time up there. They're still doing their science. And so they did a call between the two of them, and it was so great.
Integrity, this is the International Space Station. How do you hear?
Hey, International Space Station and Jessica, we have you loud and clear. How about us?
So how hard is it to make a call between two spacecraft, one of which is in Earth's orbit and the other one which is hurtling back to Earth?
I thought it would be super hard, right? However, we were told this morning that it just goes through Houston.
All right, so Houston acts like the telephone exchange and they just literally hook up.
Yeah, I might have got myself in a tiz there. It's definitely easier than I thought it would be.
We have have you loud and clear as well, and we have DME TV up, so we have a view of you right now, and it is making us so excited. We feel like you're here with us, and this is really just making our entire week right now.
So Integrity is heading back to Earth due to splashdown on Saturday morning, Australia time. And the boat that's going out to pick them up is already on its way into the Pacific Ocean to meet them at their rendezvous. Well, maybe not rendezvous point, but rendezvous area.
Yeah, rendezvous area is definitely the way to put it. So they're hoping to land near San Diego, but they have to deal with weather. So you don't want to be going through in a big storm or when there's lots of wind or anything like that. So they have about 1,000-kilometre range that they can pick up the astronauts in, and they'll work that out quite close to when they actually enter the atmosphere. And in the meantime, the astronauts are packing up all of their stuff. So everything was kind of strewn out when they were doing the scientific observations. They had all the cameras, they had all that other stuff. And now we are stowing it away for re-entry, like okay. You do on a plane.
Yeah, got to have everything up in the overhead lockers. Otherwise, that stuff could fly around the cabin.
Yeah.
So while they're packing up, we'll unpack your questions. And we have a great question from Miles, who asks, as a pilot, I'm aware of how to navigate on Earth with particular reliance upon GPS, Global Positioning System, but how do they navigate in space? And who's piloting the spacecraft? Mission Control or Victor Glover on board?
Well, we've talked about that last bit a little bit. It's mostly Mission Control that's doing it. It's autonomous as opposed to remote. But saying that though, we did a deep dive on this to try and work out how they do navigation, and they do use GPS. Well, kind of. So GPS is a satellite system. So there's a bunch of satellites around Earth. So it's really weird to me that they'd be able to use GPS in this way. It turns out that they have devices on board to be able to do the measurements in lots of different ways. So one of them is the inertial measurement units. They have GPS, they have star trackers, and they have an optical navigation camera. So two of those I thought were really interesting. So star trackers are literally what it sounds like. It uses the positions of the stars to work out exactly where the spacecraft is. And the other one is the optical navigation camera, and that uses shots of the moon and the Earth to work out the speed, distance, and position. All of that goes into the guidance computer, and then you can work out where you're going.
And we've also had a question from Josh, who asks, what happened to all the other rocket stuff after the Artemis II launch, like the space launch system and the other bits?
Yeah, this is a very good question. So after launch, the boosters operate for about 2 minutes. That's the little side bits. There's three bits. There's the orange bit and there's two little side boosters. Those side boosters, they come off about 2 minutes after launch. So they separate out from the core and they land in the Atlantic Ocean. We did used to reuse parts like this, but these ones are not going to be reused. They just go straight in the bin. Next is the core stage. That's that orange bit in the middle.
So when does that drop off?
It's about 8 minutes, and then most of it burns up in the atmosphere. But they actually try really hard to make sure that they land this stuff over the ocean. So there's an area called the Spacecraft Cemetery in the South Pacific Ocean, which is as far as you can get from any land. And over the last, you know, few decades, there's been over 200 spacecraft that's been disposed there.
Now, I've had a question from Max, who's aged 9, and he asks, when the Artemis II rocket was taking off, how did they use the explosion to make the rocket go in the right direction? And what sort of material did they use so that the explosion did not explode the whole rocket? Daisy, age 6, also had a similar question. So what's the answer, Jacinta?
So rockets run on liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. So they don't really explode in the way you might be thinking about it. They produce a controlled thrust. Think of this a little bit like the Mentos and Coke experiment. So if you put a Mentos in a Coke, it like squirts out of the top rather than the whole bottle exploding. So because there is a way to be able to release the energy, that's where it goes. It's not going to explode the whole rocket unless something goes very, very wrong.
So the rockets are designed specifically so that thrust is directed down to then hoik up the rocket out of Earth's orbit.
Hoik up. Great. I love
it. Just hoik. I believe that's the technical term. Now, we have a question about life in space from Wendy from Taupo in New Zealand. And she asks, with all the shirt pulling down in that low gravity environment, why not bodysuits?
So I don't have an answer for this one. I mean, I think that potentially you want to be having pretty similar clothes because you are in them for 10 days. And I imagine that bodysuits, especially if they were tight, would be quite difficult to get on and off, especially if you go into the toilet in a tiny little cubicle.
And we've already described how small it is in there and how Jeremy Hansen actually can't close the door properly. So trying to wriggle out of a onesie would be quite the effort, yeah. I feel.
Maybe they need more clothes. Maybe they need, like, you know, stuff on the very bottom, like those pants that you unzip.
With the snaps on the side? Tear them off?
That's not a bad idea. Snapping pants could be a nasty. We can't talk about that. We can't talk about stripper pants.
We can and we
There's
did.
There's five-year-olds in the show.
Well, we also have a question about belts, and this is a good one because you watch them and they are wearing belts in space. But Wendy also asks, surely space is the last place you need to worry about your pants falling down. With every gram counting, why waste weight on belts?
Yeah. And I mean, again, this is an interesting question. Maybe we can ask the astronauts if we ever go to a press conference. But I think if the pants were loose, they might still fall down. Maybe they'd hike up. The gravity would play an interesting role, I think. You might end up with wedgies.
Space wedgie. Yeah. I wonder, like, if they pushed off the side of the capsule, would their pants stay there and they would just kind of slide out?
No, they can't lose their pants. Okay, well, that if that was even remotely going to happen, belts are worth it, I think. They're worth the wait.
Now, if you have more questions about the mission or the moon or anything else, send them to us, sciencefiction@abc.net.au.
And nothing further here in the control room, so we'll call DPC complete. Have an excellent day.
This episode was made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Gadigal people and produced by Shelby Traynor. I'm Belinda Smith.
I'm Jacinta Bola. Don't lose your pants.